Okay, they go for it.
How's it going? I'm Daryl Lynch from Lancome. Welcome to season two of the Mojo Records Club.
Hello, I'm Andrew Mail, and you're listening to the Mojo Record Club, a place where music lovers, musicians, crate diggers, writers, readers, and special guests get to share their love for classic albums, weird lost gems, and brand new revelations. My guests today are Mojo Associate Editor Jenny Bully.
Hello.
And Dara Lynch, guitarist and multi-instrumentalist with Dublin-based dark folk alchemists Lancome. Gang, welcome to the show.
Hello.
How's it going? Thank you.
Now, Dara has been making music since, I think, the late 90s, first recording as part of a folk punk duo with his brother Ian, and then as a four-piece with Cormac McDermada and Rady Pete that has gradually morphed into the band Lancome. Since their 2017 release, Between the Earth and Sky, the Lancome sound has also transformed, moving into new and eerie sonic landscapes, constantly expanding and culminating in the beautifully bleak and hypnotically blissful False Lancome, every right-thinking person's best album of 2023. They're currently in the midst of an ongoing European tour with forthcoming dates in Southwold and Bristol before leaving for Europe in September. Before we speak to Dara, let's listen to a snippet of just how good Lancome sound in a live arena. This is their cover of DK Gavan's Rocky Road to Dublin from the 2023 Live in Dublin LP, where the group somehow transformed this 19th century hop jig into an unsettling narrative of escape and pursuit. Written by DK Gavan, arranged by Lancome, and released on Rough Trade Records.
The boys of Liverpool, when we safely landed, called myself a fool. I could no longer stand it, blood began to boil. Temper I was losing, poor old Aaron's oil. They began abusing her, and me soul says like, shillelagh, I live fly. Galway boys were boy and saw I was a hobbling with the loud array. Joined in the affray, we quickly cleared the way for the rocky road to Dublin. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hunt the hare and turn her down the rocky road and all the ways to Dublin. Whack for Aldi back.
Dara, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
That is such a magnificent live sound that you've crafted over the years, and the ability with which you've kind of brought it into the live arena is, I think, you know, one that every fan of the band kind of gets behind. The live experience is now sort of an integral part of being a Lancome fan. And I wanted to ask a little bit about that sort of hypnotic and ever-present drone that runs under everything. I read interviews with your producer and fifth member, John Spud Murphy, and he cites the influence of the likes of Sun and MBV and Horse Lords. But surely that drone has always been there in Celtic music, hasn't it? It's like bands.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some what are considered kind of the original Irish kind of instruments, like the harp and the Uilleann pipes and the whistle and stuff like that. The pipes in particular, just they have that drone inherent in how they sound. So all we've done is kind of, we've just kind of beefed it up a bit.
Yeah. And so I suppose when John's referencing things like Sun and Horse Lords and everything, he's kind of drawing that connection, isn't he, between, say, you know, Planxty or the Boys of the Loft or, you know, Tommy Potts or Luke Kelly or something. And as you said, the Uilleann pipes, he's drawing that connection with those things and the more modern use of the drone in sort of metal and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the more you look into it, the more you realise those links are absolutely there. And all we're really doing is putting more of a spotlight on them.
Yeah, but I love it. It's one of my very favourite things. I did a compilation on Spotify called Drone Morrison, which are all the Van Morrison tracks where the drone runs through it, you know. And it's something that I find it kind of uncanny and hypnotic. And I wonder kind of what your draw to it is, what your attraction to it is.
I think just all of us have this massive appreciation for things that happen slowly.
Mm.
And that kind of thing where if you repeat something for long enough, all you have to do then is make one really, really subtle change and it seems absolutely momentous.
Yes.
And like really like moves you. So we're really into that, like just keeping something going for long enough that when you shift it at some point, it really just feels like a moment.
There's a bit on the live album that you have out at the moment where Ian, your brother, I think it's Ian, says that what Lancome are trying to do is to rend a ginormous tear in the very fabric of space and time itself.
Of space and time.
Which I love the idea of folk as like time travel, of kind of bringing together different dimensions in music. And given that you have a potential source material that's, you know, spans centuries, where do Lancome start when they're going to make a record? What do you do when you sit down? Like,
we basically just sit down and write a list, because between the four of us, we'll have songs that we've picked up at sessions or songs that we've heard on records or come across in archives or just picked up somewhere along the way or just have in our repertoire from singing songs for years. And we'll just make a list of all the possibilities that we have. And as we chip away at it, we'll kind of whittle it down to the final 10 or whatever it might be to record. And even then, recording them, we'll kind of figure out fairly early on which ones are kind of keepers and which ones are kind of fall by the wayside. And we kind of just that process of getting to the final list, it kind of makes itself apparent as you go.
Mm. And with the original songs, like the two original songs on False Lancome, do you write them to fit with the traditional arrangements that you've already done? Would there be a gap and you'd think, right, what we need here is, and you'd write something, or do you have those songs already?
No, not at all. They're just on that list from the beginning as well. So they'll just be in there and we'll be working away at them. And the ones, yeah, if they sound good, they'll be in the same list as the traditional ones. I suppose they quite often sound, I think, like they could fit into a traditional repertoire anyway, just because that's probably how our brains work, just when we're writing songs, because we're so used to those kind of songs that they just come out sounding like folk songs anyway.
I was did one of these podcasts recently with Richard Thompson, and we were talking about the covering of, like, you know, folk standards and sort of, you know, child ballads and all stuff like that. And he said that you can't, if you're doing that, you can't help but become sort of historian and custodian of this stuff. And do you feel like that's happened to you, that you're reworking this stuff, but you're protective of it as well? You know, there's a sense in which you're kind of, you feel a duty to these songs, you know, to do them justice and to kind of, you know, keep the strangeness and the weirdness of them alive.
Yeah, in a way, I think we're almost paying respect in a way by treating them in a weird way.
Mm.
And we're not doing anything particularly hackneyed or kind of cheesy to them. We're kind of making an effort to not do that. We're kind of trying to go in a completely different direction. And I think that in a way is kind of paying respect to the tunes and songs themselves.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, these songs have always been strange, haven't they? And they've always been...
Oh, yeah.
You know, they've always been the songs of the people. They've also always... But they've always evolved. It's a kind of... It's anachronistic in a way that they're kind of fixed, yet they evolve. And you have to kind of balance those two things of kind of respecting the original song, yet continuing in that evolution.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. As well, yeah, it's about the best thing you do is just, like, if everyone just keeps singing them and playing them, like, that's the best thing to do. It's that classic quote from Martin Carthy, the worst thing you can do is not sing them.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's songs that you've got that have been there right from the start, haven't they, that you've kind of, in a way, reworked yourselves, that have evolved with you as a group, that kind of have been there right from the point when it was just, you know, you and your brother. You know, there's kind of
songs that
have stayed with you and have kind of you've carried along as the group's evolved.
Yeah, I suppose the most obvious one of that is Cold Old Fire that we wrote in 2008 or 2009. We still play that when we play gigs in Dublin and people go mad for it.
Yeah, but kind of the way in which you kind of, it changes as you change as well.
Oh, yeah. We'll figure out ways to add, like, I think a big thing that's been happening to us for the last 10 years is that the production quality in our gigs has just been kind of ramping up, and that's us working with Spud, the sound engineer and producer, and just really figuring out just how to get things louder and bigger and dronier and just more kind of impressive in that kind of way.
And
it's a lot of fun, and it kind of means that the songs that we're singing, they never really get boring, because, like, as we're kind of beefing them up, they're getting more and more exciting, and it's kind of even though it's the same song that we've been singing from 10 years ago, it's still a very exciting thing to do.
Mm. I was lucky enough to see you play at the Barbican last year. And
That was great.
It was a really great gig. I was saying to Andrew, mine was a bit chemically enhanced, which was accidental anyway, but it was wild. me and my friend were just like clutching each other. And you do, you know, but for a band that, you know, the sort of instrumentation means that you have to sit down and you have to be quite static. So,
yeah.
But you still really manage to engage an audience on a level that's just kind of like, you know, particularly in my state, gripped.
I'd say that's one thing that I kind of get sad about sometimes when we're like really like blasting out a drone or something like that. I'm kind of thinking, I'm never going to get to see what it's like to be in the audience while this is happening. Even nowadays, we started getting lighting engineers on board that come with us on tour. Like there's a guy, Louis Farmer from London, who's really, really good. He just did Glastonbury with us and he did the In the Meadows gig in Dublin. And you don't notice when you're on stage because you're concentrating on the music and you can't really see what's happening around you. But then you see videos afterwards of just how good the light show is and mixing with the sound and the big drones and everything like that. And it just looks so impressive.
It does. And kind of well goth as well in its moments.
Yeah.
How was Glastonbury? What was it like bringing that music into, you know, the outdoors and the countryside and sort of... you know, in a way, kind of, you know, when they talk about that idea of the veil between worlds being thin, a kind of Lancome's music, I think, kind of is very good at making that veil even thinner. But when you're actually playing in a place that has this kind of these kind of mystical connotations, what was it like?
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was really, really good. And you kind of never know going into a thing like that, just what it's going to be like or like if the music is going to translate on a giant open air stage or whatever. But yeah, just whatever way it worked. Did that park stage in Glastonbury, it was perfect and the crowd was unbelievable and it was like kind of a perfect time. It was 6 o'clock in the evening on Saturday.
Oh, ideal. And,
it was just like the sun was just starting to get kind of low on the horizon. It was just
what they call magic hour.
Perfect moment.
Yeah.
It was class. Really, really good.
One thing I wanted to talk about before we talk about the album that you've brought in to discuss today. Your first album, I think it's your first album with Ian, Where Did We Go Wrong from 2004, where you were still called Lynched. And I can hear, you know, I can hear the incredible string band in there. I can hear Planxty in there. I can hear the old folk songs and Traveller's songs. But also it seems to be that what you were doing then, whether it was conscious or not, you were drawing a connection from those songs to the punk records that you were listening to at the time and kind of saying that they're... These are songs of the people. There's a connection here. There's something going on that links the two. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was always a thing for us. We would have grown up listening to the likes of the Pogues, Dubliners, Christy Moore, and at the same time, whatever it might be, like Subhumans or Sex Pistols or Patrick Fitzgerald. And I think actually Patrick Fitzgerald is totally like, got that link for us because he was playing an acoustic guitar and kind of singing these similar songs about like, you know, working class life or whatever like that. That kind of like not a massive step away from the likes of Ewan McCall or A.L. Lloyd or any of those kind of people. So they definitely feel like they're in the same sort of world at least.
Which, I mean, I should probably then introduce the album that you've brought to talk to us about today, which is Safety Pin Stuck in My Heart, the very best of Patrick Fitzgerald. Originally released on Anagram Records in 1994. Before we discuss it, let's hear a little sample. This is the title track, Safety Pin Stuck in My Heart, written by Patrick Fitzgerald, and originally released on Pete Stennett's Small Wonder Records in 1978.
I got a safety pin stuck in my heart. Bye-yo, 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 bye-yo. I got a safety pin stuck in my heart. Fire, 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 fire. I got a safety pin stuck in my heart. Fire.
Yeah.
how's it going? I'm Dara Lynch from Lancum, and you're listening to the Mojo Record.
Dara, can you maybe remember or explain when you would have first heard Patrick Fitzgerald?
Yeah, I think I would have been like 15, 16 maybe, and Ian, my brother who's in Lancum with me, he was totally getting into the Dublin punk scene and he was starting bands. He had a band called The Gougers with John Dermody, who now plays drums in Lancum sometimes. And yeah, just this whole scene in Dublin where they'd all be going out and drinking cider and putting safety pins in their faces and all that kind of stuff. And his friend Onesie, who was in a band called Puget Sound, everyone would like make zines and make mixtapes and post each other these mixtapes. And so Onesie sent Ian a mixtape of Patrick Fitzgerald, and it was mainly songs from this compilation. And I just remember my whole family, me, Ian, and my little sister Amy, just totally got obsessed with Patrick Fitzgerald, and just this really, really like completely and utterly kind of spoke to us. And really like pure emotion from it.
He's London based, but with a Dublin heritage. Is that correct? Is that right?
Yeah, well, I'm not entirely sure if it's Dublin or not, but it's definitely an Irish heritage.
Yeah. So kind of similar to the Pogues in a way, kind of like growing up in London with an Irish heritage.
Yeah.
And what was it about the music that appealed to you?
I don't know. It's just that I think it's when you're a teenager, that kind of music that is like just all the amazing things that appeal to you when you're a teenager. Like it's really kind of defiant, kind of rebellious, very, very like pure kind of emotion to it. There's an innocence almost to some of it. And a similar buzz I would have got listening to like Operation Ivy or Stiff Little Fingers first album, like that. Just really, that kind of energy, just an energy that really excites you when you're a teenager. And I think that Patrick Fitzgerald had that in spades.
There's an anger and a sarcasm in his music as well. It's almost like he's fighting a fight that he hasn't even been asked to fight. He's not part of the industry, but he's fighting the industry. You know, it's kind of like there's a real sense, a real dichotomy as well. You know, he wants to be heard, but at the same time, he doesn't want to be pigeonholed and he doesn't want to be categorized. You know, there's a real sort of mix of emotions going on in these very short little songs.
Mm. Yeah, totally, totally. Even the ones he'll be giving out about society, saying he doesn't want to work, hates the music industry. And then has another song about how he always wanted to be famous, but he doesn't think he'll ever be famous. You're just like,
which do you want? But I love that because that seems so human. That seems so direct to sort of the experience, especially it kind of captures that sense of kind of how your emotions are when you're failing, when you're alone and you can't decide whether you want to be an existential loner or you want to be a success.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally.
I think quite early on.
But at the same time, kind of taking the piss sometimes out of that, like realising that he's doing that at the same time. Yeah, it's all going on. And really, I don't know, sometimes really like earnest love songs at the same time where he can like full-on heartbroken songs about women or whatever. And then Safety Pin stuck in my heart. I only realised after a while that it wasn't about a woman. It was actually about punk rock itself. So even like that kind of thing just totally blew my mind. He's singing a love song to punk.
Because there's All Sewn Up, the single, which is on this comp, or the demo of it is on this comp, was produced by Chris Parry, I think, The Cure's producer. And it was, I think...
I didn't realise that.
Yeah, he... I read an interview with Chris Parry where he was talking about... It was Chris that took Patrick to Small Wonder and suggested that Pete... put this single Small Wonder, because as Chris Parry said, he wanted it needed a street level, you know, kind of approach. So there obviously was a time where somebody thought he might, you know, he had the potential to, you know, to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he could have as well. I don't know. Whatever way it went, I've heard a few of his later albums and they're a lot more like, there's like electronic kind of keyboard bits, but they definitely are just a lot more like heading into like depressive territory.
Very much so. I really like there's a couple of tracks from that 1982 album Gifts and Telegrams that are on this best of, where it's kind of like you've got that kind of bedsit loneliness and despair, but you've got like the drum machine rhythms and cheap yeah. synthesizer drones and kind of, I really like those records. I kind of, if I'm honest, I kind of, the issue I have with them is I can see how Patrick's songs work on like a little EP or a 7-inch single. But when, you know, they're all back to back on this huge CD and it's just like kind of voice and guitar, voice and guitar, voice and guitar. So when it got to those songs where he's kind of experimenting with kind of minimal sort of synth sounds and drum machines, and it really seemed suited to that kind of sense of sort of, you know, loneliness and loss that is in a lot of the lyrics.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a certain point where you just, you feel like you're wading through it, and you're just like,
it's heavy, it's hard going, isn't it? Yeah, and it's kind of like he's an artist who, like, you know, if people still do mixtapes and still do sort of compilation CDs for pals, it's perfect for that sort of short, sharp shock,
yeah.
you know, where you're kind of, you've got it. And this, and also I think one of the reasons why is because even though they're short songs, there's so much going on in them emotionally and lyrically. They're intense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You can see why they really spoke to, you know, teenagers or yourselves when you were very young, though, that they are kind of plain speaking and emotional, and you listen to that and think, yeah, I could do that, and he's talking about things that I understand. And
yeah. Big time. Yeah, even like if the ones about like living in like working class neighborhoods or like not wanting to get a job, and we're like punk rock teenagers, we're like, yeah, fucking my dad wants me to get a job too, fuck off.
Exactly. I know you.
But also, I mean, Jenny raises a really interesting point. There's, you know, if ever an artist said anybody can do this while you're listening to them, it's Patrick Fitzgerald as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. And absolutely, he would have been a major influence on that first album that me and Ian made, that the Where Did We Go Wrong? Just totally, like, kind of how we started out was me. I had a nylon string guitar and Ian had his tin whistle that he used to go busking in London with. And yeah, we just, but really just as half a joke, started writing these songs together that would have been fairly majorly influenced by the likes of Patrick Fitzgerald. So it would be a case to make that Blankham wouldn't exist at all if it wasn't for Patrick Fitzgerald.
There you go.
Which is a strength. Absolutely. Probably true.
And what do you think is the link between kind of that kind of, you know, street level, emotion drenched kind of raw punk song and some of the kind of older folk songs that you're covering and listening to? You know, what is that connection point, do you think, that you, which I think Lancome finds, but what do you think it is?
I think it's just singing about a real human experience. That's yeah. like just really authentic human experience and really like just trying to translate that into a musical form. Mm. There's not a huge amount of pretense or artifice or anything like that.
No. No, there's a kind of, there's a sense of raw human experience which runs through yeah. both, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in very different forms, but kind of similar on that level.
Yeah. There's some quote, who was it? Somebody, there's some quote, I don't know if it was a historian. Somebody talking about, basically like looking through history, if you want to know what happened, read a history book. And if you want to know how people felt about it, listen to folk songs.
Yeah.
That's it. It's like just really people talking about how they feel about what's happening yeah. around them at the time.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, that's a perfect description of Patrick Fitzgerald's songs. Have you met him?
We did a gig with him once. Somebody got him over to do a few gigs in Dublin around like 2008 or something like that. So we did a couple of gigs with him in Dublin, which was a really amazing thing for us. I think I still have a poster for it somewhere in my house. But it was just a class experience. He hung around in Dublin for a few days.
And did you get a chance to talk to him and pick his brain?
We did briefly, but I can't for the life of me remember what I would have talked to him about, except probably to tell him that I was a major fan.
Yeah,
I was listening to him since I was 15 years old.
And how is he? Because one of the things, if you listen to enough Patrick Fitzgerald, you start to worry about Patrick Fitzgerald and hope that he's okay and he's doing all right.
Yeah, there was a bit of that going on. I think he was drinking a lot when he was over here too.
Yeah.
And I think he ended up in a really rough pub at the top of Stony Batter and almost got in a fight there as well. So we actually were a bit worried about him.
And have you forgive my ignorance, have you covered any of his songs? Are there any that you think
not work, recently, you know? But back in the day, I would have known how to play a lot of his songs. I used to go busking when I was a teenager to make money. I used to go busking on Grafton Street, and I definitely sang a few of his songs back then. The song Live Out My Stars, where he's singing about listening to David Bowie till late at night and kind of like, yeah, living alone in a bedsit and that kind of stuff. I definitely sang that. And Safety Pin obviously was probably the first one I ever learned, because it's just like, just hits you straight away, and it's like three chords.
Yeah.
So that was one of the first things I learned on that nylon string guitar.
I was listening to his SoundCloud. He's still posting songs on his SoundCloud, and there's a track from this year called Remember the Suffragettes, which I think is about the whole Just Stop Oil protesters and things like that. And it's, you should give it a listen, because it would work brilliantly in a as a Lancome setting. It's quite special.
Class.
And if you had to choose a track by Patrick that in a way defined your love for him and what is special about him, what do you think it would be?
The big obvious one is Safety Being Stuck in My Heart, because it's like the quintessential track or whatever. Aside from that,
what was the one that you used to busk, the Bowie one?
Live Out My Stars.
Yeah.
Who Needs to Sleep? I play bingo, or I play pinball till 3 in the night. That one, yeah. Yeah, probably that one.
We'll play that.
I listen to Bowie, I ride with him out through the stars.
It's a fantastic. So we'll play that then. It's another track taken from the Patrick Fitzgerald best of, Safety Pin Stuck in My Heart, the very best of Patrick Fitzgerald, originally released on Anagram Records in 1994.
This is called Live Out My Stars. Who needs to sleep? I play pinball till 3 in the night. I got a job, I got a home, but I like the lifestyle. I listen to Bowie, I ride with him out through the stars. I live out my heroes, try to touch them, I live out my stars.
Dora.
Amazing.
That is fantastic. Thank you so much for that record on. That was really special. And just kind of, I would never have thought coming into that record that I could see the connection with Lancome. But once I got in there, and then especially when I was listening to the earliest albums that you and Ian were doing, I could totally see the connection point. I can totally see how, you know, as you say, these are songs of real life. These are songs of people. These are songs of pain and suffering, but also sort of just prosaic existence as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And the record that made you know you could be a musician.
Yeah.
It's worth having.
Yeah, totally just like inspired us to write our own kind of weird, cheeky, sort of defiant punk songs.
Brilliant.
On an acoustic guitar.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thanks, been lovely having
you. Thank you. Cheers.
Okay, you've been listening to Dara Lynch, Jenny Bully, and myself, Andrew Mayle. That was the Mojo Record Club, and we hope to see you at the next one. You can all join in. And look in the episode description for full details of all the tracks we played, and don't forget to like and subscribe.
Thanks for listening to Mojo Record Club.
Work, rest, play, reggae.